is 57 dB weaker than that. So can you now find a well-calibrated attenuator where you really know the attenuation calibration? So you measure it at the power level you can measure it. You measure your attenuator very accurately, forward and backward, and sweep it and so on, by a quality attenuator. You can pin down an attenuator to 1 or 2 tenths of a dB out of 55, 57 dB with careful techniques. So it's a 2 or 3 step process. Step a valuable attenuator. And by the way, how accurate does it really have to be, Hal? If you've got a reasonable signal generator, like some of the Hewlett-Packard things that you have used, when you set it at minus 107 dBm, or you set it at 1 microvolt, I think with rare exception that machine is going to be to the nearest 10%. It's going to be the nearest fraction of a dB of where you want it to be. If you're using that to measure the sensitivity of a receiver, could you tolerate a couple of tenths of dB of error in your measurement procedure? I think you could.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So the accuracy of your Hewlett-Packard signal generators are so darn close to what you probably need. I mean, if you had half a dB of error in measuring the sensitivity of a receiver at 1 microvolt, I don't think that would give you a great deal of grief, but maybe it's trying to do something a lot more accurate. Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
KHRIW, K6DBC. Well, you don't have to really use a power meter. You can use a sensitive RMS voltmeter and work from there. And you're right. You have to have very accurate attenuators then go down. Because when somebody says they're getting 0.03 microvolts, readings like that, it's very hard to really pin it that accurately. A microvolt is hard enough to get accurate. When you start to say half of a half microvolt, that's a breeze in the air, Dick.
Worse than that, Dick.
Yeah, the biggest problem when you start getting to numbers like half and a quarter of a microvolt, you're getting down to numbers like minus 120 dBm. And the actual oscillator inside of your signal generator is running at around 0 or plus 10 dBm. So you're asking for 130 decibels of shielding of the cabinet of the signal generator. That's pushing it. When you start measuring numbers that level, the only thing I would trust is setting the signal generator at numbers close to that with a great big long cable that I previously calibrated, and the 50-foot long cable goes into the backyard, and I make the measurement in the backyard 50 feet away from the signal generator, so that now, even though the leakage of the cabinet is 110 dB down, because I have put 25 or 45 dB of free space loss between me and that cabinet, now I stand a chance of believing it. So, when you get down to those very low numbers, all you got to do is wave your hand around the laboratory and you see the numbers go up and down because of leakage of the instrumentation, with rare exception. Let's see how John does it. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
N2XJN.
Dick, you mentioned exactly what I was going to say. I've been there and tried to do that, and what I've done is I've set my generators, you know the generators I have, at maybe 10 microvolts. And then calibrated my attenuator. The only thing is, when you try to make those measurements, your body capacitance interferes with the measurements. It's very difficult to do. That's what I found. So, yeah, 1 microvolt, that's a tough one. KC2WGB,
net. Yeah, I think it was called the Sam Harris technique, when you run this 50-foot long cable into the backyard. You got to be a long distance away from the signal generator at that power level. Otherwise, the leakage, what you call it, body capacitance, it's really reflectivity. Signal is, a very weak signal is leaking out of the cabinet and around the type N connectors and through the double shielded coax cable and so on. Very small leakage signals are occurring between that approximately plus 10 dBm oscillator and amplifier that's inside of the signal generator. So you're asking for 140 dB of isolation and shielding between that oscillator and the receiver you're measuring. So you got to put some distance between the two. You might have a comment on this one, Hal. K6DPZ, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Now, if you're working up about 400 or 500 megacycles and such, I agree there can be leakage that could come through. But if you're making measurements, let's say, up to 30 megs on a piece of, you know, low-frequency ham equipment, then an 8640B or any jet area like that, you're going to have really negligible case leakage at all. It wouldn't even be there. But higher frequencies could get the case leakage. But accurately, to get the 1 microvolt, you have to start off higher, as you mentioned, and then precision attenuated down. That's the best approach to use. I just wanted to get your feeling on it. Very good, Dick. I was just listening to it. I got back from Dayton, by the way, today. Very interesting. KJIW, K6DPC.
Yeah, that particular rig you're using right now, Hal, is kind of hot on audio. I think you're right at the point of ramming up against the size of the IF strip of this repeater. You might want to talk a little bit softer or reset that audio amplitude. When I talked to my friend WA5EJB, Kent Britton, as he was driving away from Dayton, he had a rough estimate of 18,000 people there. Some of the spaces were empty. The swamp they had last year didn't occur. I hear tell that some of the days it was kind of hot, and some of the guys were going indoors just to get out of the heat. And did you buy a whole lot of stuff? Over to you, Hal. Wait for the beep.
RW, K6DPC. I bought a couple little trinkets. You know, nothing to go crazy about. And it was very hot. Two beautiful days. Normally Dayton is raining and musty and everything else. The weather was great. The amount of people, I agree, there weren't as many as last year from what I could tell. But all said well, it turned out to be a nice show. And driving there, driving back, it was enjoyable. And I went to the Collins dinner, and my wife won the biggest prize there at the Collins dinner.
You got to tell us, what did she win?
She won a weather station that's a ionometer, all the stuff you mount on top, comes down through a data line into a display, and it's worth quite a few $100. And it was funny because it was the last thing, and I went through all these little things they were giving out, and I was sitting there, my wife left to get some coffee, and I was holding her ticket and my ticket, and I'm winning nothing. You know, nothing comes through at all. These other people are getting books and all this stuff. The last thing they put out, which is the most expensive thing, they called a number, and it was my wife's number.
And had she returned by then, or you went and played your wife and took the thing?
She had returned by then.
Very good. Okay, Wes, I think has got a question. N2XJN, K2RAW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, N2XJN. Thank you very much. I was trying to say something about the measurement of the 1 microvolt, but it's not time for it right now. I had the subject that we didn't finish last week, and there was a misunderstanding of your side. You were pointing the formation of microwave as a negative factor, and I was pointing to you and asking you to eventually next week, that means today, just read some articles that I brought to your attention. One of them was the article by the Center of Strategy and Technology for Air War College, which says that one promising technique in wave for the new microwave weaponry is to increase the power is deformation of the waveguide. Then I went to another article and was reading the mathematics of that, and I got into the telegraphist equation. I wonder if you're familiar with that, which was utilized to actually calculate the deformation. There was another article that actually was written by Russian, and it was in the 60s, and for the army, and this one was actually standing that the synthesis is based on the following principles: deformation of the waveguide super surface at each iteration step that is defined by two field distributions and whatsoever. I wonder if you got familiar with that.
I may be missing some of the words you're saying. there's a peculiar kind of distortion on the audio. I think Eric earlier said that some of the bits are being dropped on the digital encoding. You seem to be saying that the deformation of the waveguide is increasing the power. Those are the words that I heard, and that sounds like it is almost a violation of conservation of energy. I mean, as I deform a piece of waveguide, I can make the field intensity in volts per meter go up and down. But that's not a change in power. If I'm putting into a piece of waveguide 1 watt of power, and if I don't change what I put into the waveguide, no matter how I distort and deform and filter and switch and bend and whatever the waveguide, I'm not going to get more than 1 watt out, is my belief. But the words you're using seem to suggest that you believe the article was saying something else. Maybe I'm misinterpreting. Back to you, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN, I wonder if now, right now, it's better. Well, they were actually doing the calculation using the deformation of the waveguide surface at each iteration step that was defined by two field distributions calculated using boundary conditions at the input and output of the waveguide. So the deformation is satisfied the integral equation written by the specific field representation. And they were using the Lorentz-Lima or its equivalent to calculate that. And they were satisfied with the overall conversion of the efficiency change after that deformation. So it means that deformation was a frequent parameter that was specially implemented to that. And the second thing is, did you hear about telegraphic equation and to exceed?
Yeah, the second thing you said was, did I hear about the telegraphic equation? But the first one, you're saying that each iteration, some form of change of power was taking place. Do you have reason to believe that as you read that article, that if I put 1 watt into a piece of waveguide and deform it multiple times so that on each iteration I measure power, and now after multiple iterations, could the 1 watt of original input result in more than 1 watt of continuous, not peak envelope power, I'm talking about continuous flow power. If I'm continuously putting in 1 watt, can I continuously get out more than 1 watt? Did the article from your reading of it, Wes, imply that more than 1 continuously can come out in that scenario? N2XJN, K2RIW?
N2XJN, no, it doesn't. The reason that I pick up this subject is that United States Army building a microwave weaponry sees we're analyzing a better power resources and better antennas, and we're trying to determine area of post-generation efforts and to make more efficient switches where the generator will improve, increasing of the power output. What actually I believe is happening is they were playing with two things, zero switches, and that was one of my questions to you, and deform waveguides. And they found that deform waveguides is a promising technique in the waveguide deformation. I was kind of, I believe that the concentration of the energy is not really that I'm getting a more power and I'm violating the rules of thermodynamics. No. It is a concentration of energy. And they actually were playing within the cylindrical waveguide, which would be the tightly twist copper, the insulator, and then the coat around that, which would look like a typical coaxial cable. Let me just and the firm copper waveguide Now, they were analyzing in various numbers of frequency, and they were doing also the calculation at 55 kilomega cycles, which would come to 55 gigahertz frequencies. So definitely it's the interesting article, but my question to you was not a telegraphic or telegraphist equation. Did you get along this telegraphist equation into Xia?
I might not have seen the telegraphic equation. Now, when it comes to the 55 gigahertz and or 94 gigahertz, the Army has done, and DARPA has done, some experiments where a kind of a phased array operating at that frequency at rather high power can give you a kind of field concentration. You can do what's called near-field focusing of a large phased array where over a smaller area than the phased array itself, like where a human being is located, let's say 100 yards away, you can aim this beam at that human being and he will sense an intense amount of heat on his skin, or you can modulate the signal in certain ways that will scare the living daylights out of the human being. It's a strong repulsive effect that you get. So maybe this is what you're discussing now, these very high power phased array human repulsing techniques. In other words, it's not damaging to the human being, but it will certainly turn him away if it was a crowd coming toward you, at least one person at a time. Maybe that's what you're referring to, that Doppler experiment. Over to U.S., K2RIW.
Yeah, and Jim, well, prior to that, I have sent you the email that was 2 weeks ago, I believe, which was showing, John would be able to explain it better, that just a vortex applied to the cube, which was a conical in nature, and then one of the videos that I gave you was the distance of 50 feet. The wall, the brick wall, actually fell down in the shape of exactly that. But the articles that I have read about the microwave is actually standing about the similar pattern of that. The telegraphist, T-E-L-E-G-R-A-P-H-I-S-T equation is actually V equals root K times A plus B, where the A and B would be the amplitudes of forward and backward waves in typical mode across the certain cross section, and the K is the value of the impedance. Now my question here is, what is the K wave impedance? So K is the wave impedance. Enter it here.
Got to pick up the right microphone. I did see the article about the blowing over a brick wall with these impulses in air, a ring-type impulse in air, and there was also associated with it making this bubble ring underwater, and porpoises were playing with it. But you can make an impulse in air, and it propagates rather nicely. However, air is a longitudinal propagation medium. In other words, it's a longitudinal wave that you're sending through air, and to compare that to a radio wave is difficult because the radio wave is a transverse wave. So can you do a similar thing? Can you make a pulse of energy like that with radio and send it downrange? I don't think so, but that's my first impression. But maybe John's got a different understanding of this. Let's see what John's got to say. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, I believe you're right, because the TEM is not going to function the same way, I don't believe,
The Vortex Cannon has been around for a long time. It's really old stuff. But if you saw the video, I haven't seen the one that Wesley sent to you, but I've seen those videos before. It's a, it looks like it puffs smoke rings, but of course that's condensate that's in the air when it leaves. But they have some very larger weapons like that. But as far as doing that with an electromagnetic wave, I don't believe so.
You can do near field focusing. You could take a parabolic dish or a phased array that has, let me pick a number, 20 wavelengths of diameter of the total array. And with proper amplitude and phase control of the individual elements across that array, you can focus the energy down to something in the vicinity of one wavelength in diameter when you start off with something that is 20 wavelengths in diameter. And therefore you can get not quite a 400 to 1 amplitude concentration. If I measured watts per square meter of power flux density of the radio wave coming off of the phased array at the right distance where I have decided to do near field focusing, I could make that power flux density quite a number of times larger. That's what that 50 and 94 gigahertz human repulsive weapon was doing. And it runs a very high power microwave tube to do that. It doesn't look very portable. It's almost a tracked vehicle. But that vortex thing in air, I'm pretty sure you can't do anything quite like that with a radio wave. Concentrate, yes. And when you do that, it's slightly similar to what you do when you concentrate sunlight with a magnifying glass and burn a hole in a piece of newspaper. There's a significant amount of similarity in what's going on with the magnifying glass versus the phased array doing what's called near-field focusing, as opposed to focusing at infinity, in order to concentrate as much power as you can on a particular target. N2XJN, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ.
Hey, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just as a quick note, Dick, I took a white paper of the telegraphist equation, and I sent it to you in email, so I don't know how close you are to your machine if you want to open it up and take a peek. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Give us a couple of words as to what it is and what your understanding of it is, Glenn.
I've never seen this before, Dick, but apparently what this equation is, it describes the a wavefront, and basically the equation describes the wavefront in terms of for both TE and I guess for TE and TEM type of waves, and it explains the actual components of E and H in various modes. And they talk about various modes through the coupling boundary of a horn, and then they display an equation in its basic form, and they break it down. But it's just, I've got to read this. I just started right now, so I sent it to you, and maybe we can bring it up in the next TechNet, but it looks very interesting. I've seen part of the equations before, but never displayed in this way.
A guy named Potter, P-O-T-T-E-R, invented an extremely high-efficiency horn intended as an illuminator for a high-efficiency parabolic dish. He did that in the late 60s. And W2IMU, Dr. Dick Turin, in the mid-70s, made a variation of the Potter horn, which everyone calls the Turin horn. What's good about the Turin horn is that it launches two waveguide modes simultaneously. TE11 circular, TM11 circular. And when you launch those two modes of just the right amplitude and just the right phase characteristic between the two modes, you get a triple benefit. Let me drop. The triple benefit is the horn does a beautiful job of focusing, so you get almost the exact same beam width in the horizontal plane, the vertical plane, and the 45-degree diagonal plane. You get almost the exact same beam width in all three planes. That's one good piece of news. Number two, the horn has a fixed phase center. As you look at it at various angles, it looks like all the energy is still coming from one single point in space that's somewhere inside the horn. Number three, essentially all currents flowing through the edges of the horn go to zero. At the mouth of the horn, there is essentially no current flowing. And the bottom line of all that is that this horn now has an extremely clean pattern, and it gives you no error in amplitude distribution across the dish per se. It gives you no phase error in the distribution across the dish, and it has, because of no current flowing on the horn, metal of the horn on the perimeter, it has essentially no side lobes. It's a very simple Gaussian-like pattern, although it's a little bit cleaner than a Gaussian pattern. The tails fall off a little bit more rapidly, so it's a nice clean pattern with no side lobes. And when you use that in front of a 0.6 focal length to diameter ratio parabolic dish, you get about the highest efficiency you're going to get for that particular geometry. That's what Turin did. And so Turin, Potter, and now, let me drop. There's a group of amateurs in the Czech Republic who have made an update of the Turin horn, where it's a little bit simpler construct, where the horn is rectangular instead of round, and the septum device they put down the horn is a stepped piece of sheet metal, which gives you a linear input to circular polarization output, and most of these other benefits of the Potter and Turin horn. So the hands in the Czech Republic are doing some very good work along these lines. This might be different than what you two guys are talking about, though. I don't know who should get it. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Let me grab it for a second, Dick.
Got it, John.
Wesley, this is for you. Remember, you had a very important question to ask Dick, and this is not going to go anywhere as far as your experiments are concerned, but that question you had about detecting what you were worried about, why don't you broach that question with Dick now? There's only like 18 minutes left. What do you think, Wes?
Yeah, good idea, John, and to AGM. Just a few words about that is that it is basically the way of the double script notation for the very small in round helix waveguide, and to assign the interaction between the circular electric wave and other wave in deformed helix waveguide. Deformed wave helix waveguide. That's what the United States Army was actually interested with, and they found that very much promising. But in addition to that, the reason that they got into it, because it was convenient to write the transmission line equation not in terms of current and voltages, but in terms of the amplitude of forward and backward traveling waves. This paper is from 1960s. You have it in front of your eyes. I have sent you the copy of it, and it's a page of 253, page 253. But yes, I would like to go to the next question, but before that, I give you the microphone.
Dick, while you're doing that, do you want me to explain Wesley's next question?
Okay, I got an email from Wes on May 12th at 12:54 a.m. Also on May 10th at 12:24 a.m. And the next email before that was April 29th. I'm not quite sure which one I should be looking at, but go right ahead, John.
Well, if you remember Wesley's experience when they were working with this yoke and this possible radiation that gave them headaches and whatnot, Wesley wants to know what kind of a device he can use to detect alpha, beta, and gamma. I don't think he's generating gamma waves, and he's working at 350 milliwatts. So this was his question. He wants to know, when he works on this, if he's going to be safe or not. That was a major question, which is delaying his experiments. And I don't know why he didn't bring that up, but that basically was interested. Wesley, maybe you want to make a comment if I left anything out. Over to you, Wes.
Yeah, to exam. In Lithuania, prior for me to going over there, we have had the three-party experiment in which we connected the yoke in the certain fashion, the two generators that we discussed, the effective power of the mismatch of the impedance was probably milliwatts. Now, IDAS reported that he has a very strong headache and he is losing hairs. So then 2 weeks later I came to Lithuania. There was six people in the room. We just repeat the same experiment. Apart from that, we were able to achieve the power of about 75 watts light bulb. The filament was hot. Then 150 watt light bulb. The filament was hot. That's what I didn't see. It was a 600 watts connected of the halogen lamp. The filament was hot. And then 1 kilowatt was connected and the filament was hot. All I was able to witness is 150 watts. Now, no matter if that story is to be believed to or not, it doesn't matter. The matter is that six people in the room experienced very strange headaches from milliwatts of power from two generators. I put my head and volunteered to that. Let me talk first. Okay, I volunteered to that in the room when I just went to the device and he said, I got hit. I said, I mean, come on, you have a milliwatt of power. You cannot get hit. And so I put my head next to the device. There was nothing. Two generators, only one yoke. That's it. And, of course, specially wanted. And then I put my head next to it, like approximately 10 inches to it. And I wasn't there long. I was probably about 30 seconds. Then I took my head out, and then half an hour later, I started to have a strong headache. And I felt like a part of my skin on the head was burnt or was exposed to the temperature. When I came to the United States, for about 1 week, I had that effect. So I would like to find out if that was a microwave, whatever it was. Doesn't matter if the story is to be believed to, the effect was there. And how to eventually find out what is that, because, you know, I'm stuck with that. I don't want to do it because of what's happened. And to explain.
I think if we do enough Google searches, we can find advertisements from companies that make alpha, beta, and gamma detectors. This is not my area of expertise. I don't know anything about this. Never worked with this, what I'm trying to say. I know that quite a few people walk around with a handheld device that helps them find nuclear materials. But that's not quite the same of what we're talking about here. And some of these contain a scintillation counter. Some of them contain a Geiger-Mullen tube. There's various ways of doing it, of measuring these particles coming out. At the milliwatt level, I'm with John on this one. Let me drop. At the milliwatt level, it's difficult to understand how some of these effects are possible. However, if you've got a resonance structure, it could make some very strong local magnetic fields at the resonant frequency. And would that give you the effect that you've seen is a darn interesting question. By way of putting up a magnetic field detector, you know, a loop of wire into an oscilloscope, you should be able to detect whether or not a strong resonant magnetic field is coming from that yoke. And,
XJN.
Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, sorry about that, but we have limited time for this, and it's really important. Thank you, Sean, for putting this to my, yeah. The thing is that whether it was the frequency of the microwaves, whether it was alpha, beta, gamma, whatever it was, it happened there. And the question is, with the microwaves, all I need is just a spectrum analyzer, nothing else. But then, if we're dealing with alpha, beta, gamma, which is a frequency of 4 terahertz and up, would then the scintillator or the radiation meter be able to react with it? And yes, I confirm. We had that small device, we spoke about it quite a good few times ago. There was the electromagnetic field meter. I don't remember what was the reading on it. I have to confirm it with the people, but the strength of the field was tremendous. I mean, it was tremendous. It was hitting the scale of that meter. And the guy then went to the end of the room. And at the end of the room, he found out that the strength of the meter was also a big one, but I don't want to give the figures before I would be able to have something solid and to achieve.
Quick comment, Dick.
You got it, Chuck.
Dick, I suggested to Wesley, if it's soft X-rays, hard X-rays, alpha particles and gamma, I don't believe, but it's all the same. A simple film carrier with some high-speed film, the film would definitely be fogged. In development, you know, you do one as a control piece, unexposed, and one exposed. That will eliminate the possibility of high-energy particles. That's my belief. What do you think?
That's quite good. The level at which you are going to get grief to a human being, I'm reasonably sure, but I'm not positive, that it will expose film. So if the film doesn't get exposed, then it suggests, not perfect, but it suggests that the human being in that vicinity should be safe from the usual kinds of nuclear radiation. Microwave radiation, with the right kind of an antenna, should show up on a spectrum analyzer screen. I don't know of any kind of microwave energy that won't show up on a spectrum analyzer screen, and yet it can still give you grief to a human. And it takes something in the vicinity of 10 milliwatts per square centimeter for something like 10 minutes, 6 minutes at least, to start giving grief to the eyes of a human being, to start giving grief to the skin on the head of a human being, takes a lot more than that of microwaves. And you would feel the heat almost immediately. The amount of RF energy that would give you a skin irritation from microwaves, you're going to feel the heat, is my belief. I'm back to you, John. K2LIW.
KC2QIQ.
Fun recognized. But Dick, if almost 80% of the microwave energy is repelled by the skin or reflected off the skin, you're dealing with 350 milliwatts. What's left? Take a Dick and then pass it over to Glenn.
Yeah, 80% is reflected off the skin if it's above 1500 megacycles. Between 30 and 300 megacycles, closer to 100% is absorbed by the human being, but it goes down a centimeter or two of depth of penetration into normal skin. Again, the amount of RF energy that's going to give you grief, you're going to feel it as heat. I've talked to people who have gotten in front of very strong radars, and they felt the heat immediately. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Interesting stuff, Dick. Just unfortunately, going back to the other this telegraphist equations, it's kind of interesting. I found another article here from the Australian National University, one of their engineering programs on transmission lines, and I sent this one it's a PDF file, basically on the same for transmission lines, and on page 9, if you do get a chance to look at that email, I don't know if you're going to have enough time to go over it, it kind of explains it pretty carefully, but I don't know if you want to spend a couple of minutes on it at the end of the TechNet, but back to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ, but that, the second email is interesting, that's the one that says transmission lines.
Yeah, you're fairly sure that you've mailed me a couple of emails in the last 20 minutes, and unfortunately they haven't arrived here yet. I know what your email return address looks like, and I don't see that return address when I checked my email over the last few minutes, Glenn.
Yeah, one was sent at 11:37 and the other one was sent at 11:52. But maybe you just have to hit the refresh button.
I'm doing that. I'm doing that, and they haven't arrived yet.
Oh, well, sounds like a topic for next week. But if they do come in and you're still around, maybe you might want to shoot to that page number 10. Very, very interesting.
And was it one of the pages that Wesley issued last week?
No, it isn't, Dick. These are just, I did a couple of searches here over a couple of universities and just see if, and telegraphist equations. I never heard of them before. That's why it's kind of interesting. Seems to be more of a European term than a U.S. term. But basically it just describes wavefront B&H characteristics and impedance of transmission lines. And to sum it all up, basically with they treat a waveguide as a infinite series of transmission lines. Very, very interesting. You do get a chance to look at it later. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
What is the advantage of considering a piece of waveguide as an infinite series of transmission lines?
I have not a blithering idea. I'm just looking at this for the first time, and it's just fascinating because I've never seen it represented in this way.
You've got it, Wes.
Yeah, thanks. Well, we have a few minutes left. I usually, the last weeks I have 15, 20 minutes just to pick up the subject I'm carefully preparing and sending to Bernie. It's very much upsetting that after a few weeks having the repeater on, after 12 o'clock they start to disconnect the repeater one day only. And I feel like it's being targeted on me. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm right, but I believe there is something wrong with God that is going on. I mean, this is very much unfair. This shouldn't happen. The repeater is 24 hours a day, and Sunday switch off at 12 o'clock. I mean, we cannot even discuss what you're teaching us, what you're giving us, because of this fact. Enjoy seeing.
Yeah, but the stopping at 12 o'clock, Wes, is a request that I made, because I'm going through a fairly intense period with my employer. I've got to keep him happy, otherwise I don't have a cash flow and I can't remain in this expensive area where I live. Six Hills is not cheap. I don't have to pay that much, but the people across the street from me are paying nearly $30,000 a year in property tax. Thank goodness my older house is a bit cheaper than that, but not a whole lot cheaper than that. So I've got to keep my employers happy so that I get a cash flow so I can stay alongside of the radio tower that I put up 10 years ago, if you know what I mean. So the cutting off at midnight is my request, unfortunately. I don't know who we should go to right now. K2RIW, I'd be listening.
Dick, what Wesley's trying to say is even after you leave at 12 o'clock, he wants us to continue the discussion of what you related to us, so that's why he's upset. KC2WG.
Understand. You guys are listening to TechNet number 1,399. We're about to go to 1,400. And by the way, when I watched that documentary program about Johnny Carson, he was on the air with The Tonight Show 3,500 hours. Believe it or not, I've spent in the vicinity of 3,000 hours on the TechNet over the last 30 years. And he's got a whole lot of recordings. He's got a huge room of recordings of his Tonight Show. Okay. I don't know who gets it. K2RIW.
He was an amateur astronomer also, Dick. Wesley, over to you.
Yeah, magician, amateur astronomer, quite a character.
Yeah, and so, Jen, well, Dick, I have nothing against for you to just start to take it at 12 o'clock. But if you're giving us any certain information and we have a chance to discuss that and eventually to understand better what you're giving us, that's fair. But if then the repeater stops, there is no more discussion. And I have 15, 20 minutes just to do it. So all of that was requested by Bernie to give all of this information that was actually started about 7 months ago and created a certain notion. It's simply something that I don't understand. I feel very much unsatisfied with that. And so is here. John, I wonder if Dick was able to listen to the end of my transmission. Yes, I can. Okay, John. I'm
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.